four very small matters before I introduce our speaker. If you have a cell phone or a pager, if you don't mind taking it out and silencing it, turning it off, giving it to a staff member to take away, do anything to make the evening quiet. We are recording this evening, so our recordings are archived on our website, and we actually have a nice set of recordings that go back to early 2008. So please check our website for some of our past events. If you are new to the library, and I know that some of you are guests this evening, we do publish a couple of newsletters, Library Notes, which is a large format, which as a member you receive, and Events, which we publish in print. We also publish it on our website, and both of these are full of information, and Events in particular will keep you focused on the exciting programming we do here at the Society Library. Finally, gifts to the library's annual fund are essential to our day-to-day operations, and they really do help make evenings like this one possible. I want to thank all of those of you who have already supported the library this year and encourage everyone else to send in their contributions. Our program handout, of course, gave you lots of information on Mr. Morris's background, and I know that a number of you here in the room know him well. So let me just add a couple of very quick other notes. Mr. Morris's new book on Pulitzer has been hailed as one of the top 10 biographies of 2010 by Booklist, has been lauded by the New York Times Book Review and the Wall Street Journal, and is now a Book of the Month Club alternate selection. His book tour has taken him on some interesting travels the last while, I understand. He's been at the Library of Congress this year, where he spoke as part of the Center for the Book, Books and Beyond series. He's appeared on PBS NewsHour and C-SPAN, and he's had a very busy week here in New York and will actually be doing a presentation in a couple of nights' time at the New York City Bar Association. So if you enjoy this evening and want to send your friends who are not here tonight to another venue, the Bar Association do a great program down the road. This book is now in its third printing, which is great, and we are pleased to have its author with us. After Mr. Morris's talk, he will be available to sign books. Please join me in welcoming James McGrath Morris.
My stock has risen tonight among my two sports fanatic sons. There's a Yankees game on, and you're here, so I'm very touched. This is a thrill for me for a lot of reasons. To be able to talk in such a distinguished library is always an author's dream. There's also a personal thing. After spending 5 years closeted writing about somebody, it's also nice to be able to talk about them to an audience. So, after 2 or 3 hours, if I've gone on for too long, don't hesitate to leave. It's also very interesting because I'm talking in Pulitzer's neighborhood. His house is on 73rd Street. So it's, you know, I'm coming back to one of the spots. I doubt very seriously, knowing what a recluse he was, that he ever came here, but it is still his neighborhood. It's also touching to see a lot of friends here and have the support of some of my family members like George and Nani Frelinghuysen. Also a little terrifying because those of you who know me know what a checkered past I have now, and to be in a nice tie and jacket talking about a serious matter may be funny to them. And it would be amusing and very pleasing, and then I'll begin my talk, if somebody else could be here. 101 years ago yesterday, my father was born a few blocks away from here. And I like to think he was dragged here at some point to read books. And I haven't gone through the cards yet to learn what books he checked out if he did. But at least he could know that I did finally amount to something. Anyway, I'd like to try to give you a sense of this man's life. And one of the reasons that I enjoy doing it is that when I started this book, and I said I was writing about Joseph Pulitzer, people would say, oh, great, Pulitzer. And then you could see this kind of blank expression come over their faces because they knew the name, but they didn't know what he'd done, which is lesson number one. If you make a lot of money in life, don't endow a prize because everybody remembers the prize and they have no idea what the heck you did. Well, Pulitzer's life, like many 19th century giants, began in a very faraway place. This is a photograph of Mako, Hungary, a small town near the Romanian border. This is I was very lucky to find this photograph. It was done around the time, and it's maybe a little fuzzy. But over here, you can begin to see one of the Jewish stores that was in that town. Pulitzer was born to a Jewish family in 1847, one of nine children, all of whom, except for his brother, died before Pulitzer turned age 13, as well as his father. So one of the most consistent elements in this man's life at the start was death. This is part of the equation that will propel him to leave Hungary. He comes to the United States through a rather interesting and circuitous route. This was the fourth year of the American Civil War, and we were having a problem persuading young men to go to war. This was the war that was only supposed to last 6 months. If you remember, it was going to be such fun that one of the first battles, everybody left Washington, just like a sporting event, to go and see it until they started seeing blood and realizing this was serious. Well, in the fourth year, they instituted the draft. But if you could write a check for $300, you could get out of the draft. Yet that community still had to find people. So a group in Boston very cleverly sent a recruiter to Europe, paying young single men to come to fight in our Civil War for the Union side. These illustrations are recruitment tents, one of which was down at Park Row here in New York, right near City Hall Park. And that's where Pulitzer joined up. Age 17, lying about his age, not speaking a word of English, he became a member of the Union Cavalry. And he got some cash for doing so. He left behind his mother, who is the heavier set woman on the right, and that's one of his sisters who'd already died, but this photograph is an earlier photograph. Pulitzer was very attached to his mother. And remember, immigration in the 19th century is a one-way street. You don't catch a cheap Delta or Virgin Air flight back home to Odessa for the next holidays. You're very often saying goodbye forever to your parents and your family. Well, in the course of my research, I ran across this unusual item, and there's a story to go with it. So I want to go through these so you can see them a little more clearly. This is the back side of the coin, and I'm going to show you the front side again, so you can see what it is. This is an 1864 gold dollar. That's a U.S. dime next to it today. If you ever read in the 19th century that people sewed currency into their clothing so they wouldn't lose it, that's weeks, if not months, of wages. You can't lose it. Well, Pulitzer, with the first money that he got from joining the troops, went down the street to a jewelry store, took his gold dollar that you see, and had that hole drilled in it. And on the back side, he had his mother's initials carved in. This is a Hungarian fashion accessory. My grandmother used to put her Kleenex in her sleeve like this. Hungarian women had these little sort of handkerchief rings, and they would hold their handkerchief up with that. What Pulitzer was doing by sending this back to his mother was the equivalent of a modern text message, "I'm okay, I made it in this new world." Now, for those of us who are tracing a man's life, there's also a terrific psychological clue here to his disposition towards his stepfather. The initials he carved in was his mother's maiden name, not her newly married name. So we get a sense of what he felt about his dad. This artifact surfaced because in the 1950s, when the Soviets invaded Hungary and life was tough, Hungarians wrote letters to their famous rich relatives, the Pulitzers, saying, "Send me care packages." And Joseph Pulitzer II couldn't figure out which ones were real and which weren't, sent an attorney out to sort it out. One of the family members sent this, and the only way they could have had it is if it had been authentic. I mean, you don't find an 1864 gold coin from the U.S. and Hungary by accident. So as I mentioned, he joined the Civil War. He did not see any fighting. But at the end of the war, he begins his introduction to American society in an extraordinarily significant American event. This is the Grand Review coming down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. And why, to me, this was so interesting is that they gathered originally right up here near the Capitol. So here is this young man, age 17, who's been in an army, who witnessed something quite remarkable, having grown up in an imperial state. While he was in the army, his colleagues voted in the presidential election, meaning they could vote against their commander-in-chief, even though, as you know, Lincoln won overwhelmingly. But what a novel experience for this man leaving the oppression of Hungary. Now, here he is, standing next to the U.S. Capitol, which we take for granted. But understand, this is the architecture of democracy. It's one of the first buildings built exclusively for our parliament. The many of the European buildings in Budapest, and Buda particularly, were imperial buildings that might have later become occupied by more democratic institutions. So his introduction to the United States and to democracy is very dramatic, the war and then coming to that building. But like after many wars, and you'll notice the similarity after many wars, Union soldiers found it hard to find work when the war was over. So he came to New York. He was a bum in New York, sleeping on park benches, having no luck finding work. So he moves on to St. Louis, Missouri. These are scenes of St. Louis back then. Now, why St. Louis? He offers us no clue as to why, but I think we can figure it out fairly easily. Pulitzer spoke German, no English. There's several cities in the United States at this point that are essentially German cities. And St. Louis, there were five or six daily papers published in German. There were neighborhoods with German street signs where you could function speaking German. So think of him as like a modern-day Latino immigrant. You're not going to settle in the fields of Northern Iowa where no one speaks Spanish. You're going to go to a barrio where people speak Spanish. To mix our metaphors, Pulitzer chose St. Louis for its German-speaking barrio. And that's where he began his rise in American society. And one of the connections he has to this institution is this building. This is a different kind of private library. It's called the Mercantile Library in St. Louis. In the 19th century, wealthy people in St. Louis were worried about young single men because they lived in boarding houses and they had a room, but they had no place to just sort of hang out, if you pardon the 21st century expression. And if they didn't have a place to hang out, their choices were to go drinking or to go to houses of ill repute. Not exactly what these civic leaders wanted the young men to do. So they created the Mercantile Library in St. Louis, which was open late. You could read newspapers and magazines. And for somebody like Pulitzer, you could learn English. And that's where he began to acquire the tools, linguistic tools of success in St. Louis, thanks to a private library just like this institution. He also bumped into a remarkable group of people. St. Louis had Hegelians, these philosophers who gathered there, and they believed that in the New World, St. Louis would become the capital of the United States, and it was emerging as a major city. So he met a forward-thinking group of people. But among the people he met and that influenced them the most is the fellow on your left, Carl Schurz. Who maybe when he lived in New York, he may have been a member here. He is the most famous of the German emigres from the 1848 revolution. He becomes a senator from Missouri, later a cabinet secretary. But at this point, he's co-owner of a newspaper called the Westlich Post, of which Pulitzer becomes a reporter there. Now, this is a daily paper published in German. And you'll see that it's very tied to reform. This is one of the earliest cartoons I could find of Pulitzer by Kepler. And you'll notice that the thing has both the paper's name and the sense of reform. The German Americans in St. Louis were part of a group that were opposed to radical Republicans. They began to have the moniker, which may sound oxymoronic today, liberal Republicans, in that they had notions of reform that the mainstream Republicans didn't. And the Westlich Post was one of its champions. They were particularly upset with corruption in St. Louis County. One of the most famous things going on in St. Louis County at the point is they were building a new state, a county insane asylum, just outside of the city limits. And one of the men, a guy named Augustine, had the contract to dig the well. And he was being paid by the foot. Now, I always pause here because I think somebody begins to think this through. Paid by the foot, what's the incentive to strike water? There is no incentive. He dug the second deepest well on the globe in the 19th century. The deeper one was in Belgium. Pulitzer, who was beginning to acquire language and using it in journalism, dubbed it the Well of Fools. And that's when he began to have these fights with members of the old guard. And then in 1869, which, by the way, if you notice the date, the next day after this cartoon, he is accidentally elected to the state legislature. Minor problem, he's too young, but just like he lied before about his age to join the army, he lies about his age again to become a member of the lawmaking body of Missouri. The reason is partly an accident, is that he got nominated by Republicans in his ward, and at that point, the only people who could get elected in Missouri were Republicans. because the only people who could vote were Republicans, the newly enfranchised black voters, who certainly would vote for the Republican Party. Democrats couldn't vote anymore. They were disenfranchised through all the laws unless they signed a loyalty oath. And the loyalty oath said something like, if your cousin three times removed once fought for the Confederacy or said something nice about the Confederacy, forget about voting. So just getting the Republican nod got you into the state legislature. This is the scene of Jefferson City, Missouri, back then, new capital they have now. And this is the third intoxicating element in Pulitzer's almost overwhelming devotion to the notions of democracy. Here he is in the United States, less than 5 years in the U.S., newly minted citizen, making laws of the land. Now, we as modern people begin to think of state legislators as being unimportant or chaotic or whatever you want to, adjective you want to use for what goes on in Albany. In the 19th century, this was government. The federal government was this minor actor in a swamp-filled place in Washington. The laws against murder were state laws. The laws of education were state laws. Basically, any law that you lived under was made by the states. So here he is with farmers, lawyers, and others making laws in his new country, an intoxicating moment for him. People love to cartoon him. This is a cartoon. Again, you'll see several of them featuring his different... Joseph Kepler, who is a rival to Thomas Nast, whenever he was bored, would put Pulitzer in the back of his cartoons. If you see, here he is over here. I like to think this is an allusion to an important moment in Pulitzer's early life when he worked as a waiter in St. Louis, dropped a tray of food in the customer's lap, and then berated the customer. Early indication of anger management problems. This is the more famous one that I ran across, which tells a wonderful tale. The heavyset guy is Augustine, that lobby, that contractor I was telling you about who was living off the taxpayers' money in the county. This is Pulitzer as a legislator who has just introduced a bill weakening the county government, thus about to put this fellow out of business. They meet at the Schmidt Hotel in Jefferson City. Pulitzer and he exchange some really awful words, such as the word pup, P-U-P, which in the 19th century was an invitation to a duel. Pulitzer went back to his hotel room, brought out his gun. Apparently, legislators back then all packed heat. He came back to this dining room, and he took two shots at Augustine. Now, any of you are military veterans, I'm not casting aspersions on the American military training. But two shots, he missed a guy the size of a barn. He only managed to graze him in the leg, and in this moment, Augustine is disarming him. Now, when I tell this story, which is quite kind of an incredulous story, people accuse me of making it up because Augustine has a certain physical similarity to the author, but this is a true 19th century cartoon. Pulitzer goes on to lose 12 months later in the next election. And the reason this is, again, a seminal moment in his life is that he loses because of his own work. He is part of this group of Republicans who believes that the Civil War is over, Democrats need to be re-enfranchised. By doing that, by getting Democrats to vote again, of course, his district, which is Democratic, is going to throw him out, and that's in fact what they do. And I tell you the story because I want you to understand, before he moves into journalism, this is a highly principled, idealistic young man who's been fighting against corruption, opening up democracy even to his own loss. But he never ceases to work in reform. This is a cartoon done in connection with the Liberal Republican Convention. I think I have one of him heading off to it. Yes, with Schurz, Pulitzer, and Grosner. They're off to Cincinnati, where they make the mistake of holding a convention that they don't control. It's easy to call a convention, very hard to control it, and they nominate Horace Greeley to be their candidate for president, and they sink to a defeat that fall. All of them run back to become Republicans, except for Pulitzer. He can't. He becomes a Democrat. So now we move the story forward to the turning point in his life. This is a cartoon in 1878. The building you see in the background with the tall columns is the St. Louis County Courthouse. This is the same courthouse where the Dred Scott decision was made many years ago. And what's going on the steps is the sale of a bankrupt afternoon paper. Pulitzer's newly married to a young woman from Washington named Kate Davis. He has about $300 left to his name. Well, he has actually $3,000. And he spends $2,500 to buy this bankrupt newspaper. And all his friends think he's absolutely nuts. But this is the seminal illustration of Pulitzer's genius. He's not like Edison or Bell, who thought, you know, we need a gadget to talk to each other down a telephone line or anything like that, or Google, you know, we need something to... I mean, these are clairvoyant people who create something new. Pulitzer was able to see huge social trends and harness them to his use. The modern equivalent, and you'll think I'm nuts when I ask you to bear with me in this analogy, if you've ever been to the coast and seen a surfer, they're out past where the waves are cresting, where the waves just undulate slightly, and they're lying very still. And all of a sudden, they begin paddling madly and rapidly, and they rise up on a wave that seems to come from nowhere, and they find the best surfers find the best waves. Pulitzer found the best social, cultural, and economic waves of the 19th century and rode them. Well, what were they at that point? There was the invention of the gas light and the electric light that allowed you to read in the evening. Farmers were leaving the farms in Missouri and Illinois and coming to the cities and becoming commuters. Women who had run the farms were now becoming economic decision makers and having to do purchases in town. The Victorian internet had been invented. We call it the telegraph, bringing news from New York and Washington from that very morning to that afternoon. You could get the latest. So Pulitzer took this dying afternoon paper and published it with news fresh from that day, with economic information, such as where to buy advertisement, where to buy gingham, where to buy flour, entertaining news so the commuters would read it on the way home, and lo and behold, in no time, his paper became established as one of, I'm going to go back to this in a second, as one of the major newspapers in the West, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. This cartoon is when the other afternoon paper went bankrupt. He bought it, sold off the components, and the third one merged with him, making the Post-Dispatch. So Pulitzer was now becoming an American publisher of some repute and some power in St. Louis, but all of you know in New York that the real center of the real center of the world is New York City. And in the 19th century, this was the capital. And I know somebody's going to remind me again about that place in Washington, D.C. No. This was the economic capital after the Civil War. This was the cultural capital. This was the musical capital. Everything that was worth happening happened here, particularly in the newspaper world. Down near City Hall was Park Row, where all the newspapers of worth were being published. So Pulitzer came to town with his formula from St. Louis. This is a very rare photograph I found of the New York World that when it was owned by this fellow, Jay Gould. I wonder if he was a member of the library. And he owned a newspaper by accident and was glad to get rid of it, but he relished the moment because for years Pulitzer had been attacking him as one of these awful robber barons in the paper, right and left, and here he was not only selling him the paper, but lending him the money, owner finance, so I'm sure he enjoyed every moment of that. This is a photograph, early photograph of the interior, very gentlemanly business back then, which is what we're going to get to. This is what the New York World looked like. Boring is an understatement. And, you know, dynamite in Haiti is as big as Cornetti's Last Night. No variation headlines, no illustrations. In fact, sometimes to read those papers, you had to read to the end of the story to find out the war was over because it was written like a letter. You know, dear readers in New York, the fog is lifted in New York, in London, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly, oh, by the way, the war is over. In a few years, this is what the world started to look like. Not only did Pulitzer reinvent journalism by bringing in color, headlines, dramatic leads, but he also began to invent other interesting things. And this is, of course, you're about to see the most significant invention of the 19th century, the Sunday color comic, which led to a moniker he later gets. But there was a lot more going on to Pulitzer's journalism. In this next slide, you will see what are called the newsies, or sometimes street Arabs, street urchins. These are immigrant children earning pennies selling the newspapers on the street. And if you've ever seen the movie The Newsies, I'm sure your children have, just be forewarned, that's Hollywood. The strike that's portrayed in that movie has a happy ending. If you care to read my book, you'll discover it's not a happy ending. But anyway. Now, there are a lot of things going on with the newsies, more than just selling a paper. These are illiterate kids, so they have to sell the paper vocally. They have to be able to use a headline, which is the beginning of the headline you see in the New York Post and Daily News to this day. Short, terse headlines, like that famous one in, was it when Ford was president, what, in 75, New York, drop dead, you know, that kind of. Of course, there's the apocryphal one that the fake New York Post once did. Michael Jackson and 40 million others perish in nuclear attack. But part of what's going on is you're beginning to see the invention of all of the cultural habits we have today of consuming news. Because not only did Pulitzer publish a morning paper, he published an evening paper. Now, if you're my age, you think of an evening paper as something that comes out 3 in the afternoon with some old news. No, these papers began publishing at 9 in the morning and would often publish every hour on the hour with the latest. Just the way you turn to CNN when there's a trial on, people would go out on the streets and for a penny buy the trial's account. When Harry K. Thaw, possible member of the library, shot Stanford White. No, he couldn't have been a member of the library, sorry. And the trial occurred. Irving Cobb sat at the front of the courthouse. He wrote out his story longhand, handed it to a copy boy who went downstairs to an open phone, dictated it back to the world, who then would go out on the street an hour later with the latest from the Harry K. Thaw trial. This is the kind of news gathering and news dissemination business that Pulitzer was establishing in New York. It also took all the money away from Bennett and Dana. You can see Pulitzer here stealing all of their money. It made him incredibly powerful. This is a cartoon of him being responsible for Cleveland's election, the first Democrat elected to the White House since before the Civil War. If you do the electoral math, you will see that the 1880 election was lost by losing New York by about 1,500 votes. The 1884 election won New York's electoral votes, putting Cleveland into office by 1,500 votes. The big difference between the two, Pulitzer had arrived in New York and was creating and running the most powerful newspaper in the country. Pulitzer finally got something he really wanted by accident. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives. I'll get back to that guy. This is a cartoon of him. Notice what he's doing. He's leaving the House of Representatives because he goes down there, and after 3 or 4 months, he says, "This is boring," and leaves and goes back to New York, leaving his district by resigning without any representation. And he obviously hadn't read the Constitution. You have to be elected to be in the House. So that means kids who wanted to go to West Point and things like that had no one to sponsor them for a number of months. So here's Pulitzer in 1884, so powerful that he's accidentally elected to the House of Representatives, running the most widely circulating newspaper on the globe. And one of the things that he is building a circulation on is the new immigrants coming to New York. He looked down to the Lower East Side not as a threat, as many other newspaper people did, but as future readers. So he admonished his reporters to go and write about their lives. So people on these kinds of neighborhoods would have opened up their paper, The World, and seen, "Tiny Tot falls to its death as mother looks on." And one of them would have said, "Oh, this is just such sensationalistic prattle. How dare he publish this?" And in fact, some libraries got so upset they didn't carry The World anymore. But they were missing the point. If you went down to the Lower East Side and you went into the black and tan bars or the overcrowded dining rooms in those tenements, that's what they were talking about, because these were real happenings. It got so hot in those dumbbell-shaped tenement buildings with 40, 50 families in them that at night they would go to the roofs of the houses to sleep, and children indeed would roll to their death. Jacob Riis described it in an article called The Human Rain. So when Pulitzer wrote about their lives, there was a magic that was going on. And the magic is no different than, and this is just an analogy, so please don't panic, but if you were to invite me to your homes tonight, on your refrigerators are clippings. Clippings of a son and daughter's achievement, a wedding, a sad news obituary. These happenings occurred irrespective of being put into print. But print gives them a dignity, a remembrance, a power that's very different. That's what Pulitzer was doing for the lowest classes of New York, and they were rewarding him by buying the paper day after day. And in return on Sundays, they would get a paper as thick as a telephone book with sheet music. This is long before, young people, downloads that you get on your iPods or anything like that. You could get the latest music of that week, take it home, and play it. all in the Sunday paper. Economic news that you could use to get ahead. Dress patterns that you could cut out. Serialization of novels so you could learn this mysterious English language. It was all in the Sunday world. And so Pulitzer had this extraordinarily intimate relationship with the dispossessed of New York, which brings me to this story in 1885. This, of course, you recognize as the Statue of Liberty being assembled in Paris. I'm going to just take a sip here. The Statue of Liberty, if you remember, was a gift of the French people to the American people, not the French government. And our obligation was to raise the money here privately to put it up and build a pedestal out in the harbor for it to be erected. Unfortunately, money was not coming in. So Pulitzer wrote, had a front page story in his paper about the shame of the United States not to do this, and an editorial saying, bring me your money, readers. I will hold on to it, and I will turn it over to them. Now, this may not seem like much, but Pulitzer is this powerful, rich, almost a member of the robber baron group. And he's saying to the poorest people in New York, bring me your pennies and dimes. That's like Citicorps or somebody sending you a letter saying, you know, send me a check. And yet, day after day, they came into the paper with the pennies and nickels. And in return, the paper published their name. So the paper that had the Vanderbilts and all of the great families of New York would have these little kids' and little families' names published on the front page. Of course, they'd also buy that copy because they'd want to keep it. So the money came in, and of course, as you know, the statue went up. There is now a sculpture to Pulitzer out there to remind us of that role. Now, in 1888, after this is all done, and Pulitzer's at the height of his power, something happens to him. He begins to fall blind. So just like Beethoven, who can't hear his own music, Pulitzer can no longer read his own newspaper. But it continues to grow in importance, and it needs a new headquarters. So he begins to plan to build a building down on Park Row. Lesson number two of tonight, you remember the one about not leaving your money for a prize? Lesson number two is that revenge is a dish best served cold. He bought where a hotel had been, French's hotel, that had kicked him out as an indigent, unemployed soldier from its lobby 20 years earlier. He tore it down to build his headquarters. And I'll show you several photographs of the building. This is the New York World Building. One is a photograph on the right. The Brooklyn Bridge would be back there, and these are where all the other papers are. And this is one more view of it. I'm going to jump forward because I want to tell you something about... No, I guess I won't. Sorry, different set of slides. There's an architectural symbolism to this building that really represents what Pulitzer did. I've described how he's changed the journalistic landscape of our country. We've become news consumers. We begin to think of news as a form of entertainment with a driving story. He's created a public that reads the newspaper, these disenfranchised new members of our society. Well, he does something rather extraordinary with this building. It is the tallest building in New York, in fact, the tallest building on the globe. It's taller than Trinity Church, and the top is a gold leaf dome. So I want you to imagine the next wave of immigrants who are coming to the United States in 1890. They enter New York Harbor. Again, they've risked their last pennies to come here. And they come by the Statue of Liberty that you see out there, and they may or may not know that those who came before made it possible for its erection to be standing there on that island, but they certainly are aware of its symbolism. And now they turn and they get their first view of New York, their first view of the new world where they're going to establish themselves. And if the conditions are just right, the light is coming off that building and striking them. And it's not a monument to commerce, not a monument to banking, not a monument to agriculture. It's a monument to the American media. The only constant, explicitly protected in the U.S. Constitution, and more specifically, a monument to the New York World, the newspaper that will become their introduction to society, their introduction to economics and politics, and their paper. So you'd think Pulitzer's going to have a glorious end to his life. Well, we have a couple more little incidents that are going to occur to him. The first is that with this wave of immigrants, New York turns virulently anti-Semitic. And Pulitzer, who's not only blind, which, by the way, is a calamity in the 19th century, Unlike today, blind people were thought it's an affliction that you shouldn't be seen with. That's part of the reason he becomes a recluse. Helen Keller had not yet changed the world for blind people. So Pulitzer's a recluse, being tormented by all kinds of psychological devils, and this is the way he starts being portrayed in the press. They refer to him as having talons. The journalist re-spells his last name to combine the word Jew and Lucifer. I mean, New York becomes a very inhospitable place for him. Moreover, another fellow arrives, William Randolph Hearst, who, unlike Pulitzer, who Pulitzer's made every dime himself, William Randolph Hearst has his mother's checkbook. She's inherited the family's fortune. And he buys a newspaper in New York, which had once belonged to Pulitzer's brother, Albert, and begins a life and death struggle with Joseph Pulitzer, with the famous New York Journal. This is a photograph of a journal on Park Row. And I want to tell you one more thing about Park Row before we get to the end of this story. Park Row wasn't just where newspapers were published. It's where you went. It was a social happening. Do you see all these people lined up? If you want to know who had won the election, you go down to Park Row, because otherwise you have to wait for the paper to come out. And on the second story, they would put all of the latest news. Well, this is just news. When America's Cup was being waged, they had little miniatures of the yachts, and they moved them based on the latest telegraphic reports. In fact, there was a boxing match on one of the Caribbean islands that was being reported by telegraph, and the marionettes were reenacting it. The crowd so loved it, they asked for a repeat, a reenactment. Think about this. 100 years before ABC's Wide World of Sports, instant replay at Park Row, and you think they invent new things today. Well, what worked to William Randolph Hearst's advantage was this incident. The Maine is blown up, or I should say blows up, because it wasn't done by the Spaniards, in Havana Bay, triggering the Spanish-American War, for which he had wanted, and both newspapers begin to engage in extraordinary excess. You'll begin to see the kinds of illustrations, raising the question, Maine explosion caused by bomb or torpedo, the New York Journal, crisis is at hand, and they begin to carry on this kind of competition until they get what they want, which is war. And at one point, both newspapers are selling 1 million copies a day in a country with 64 million people. And if you think and I don't mean to betray my politics, but if you think Fox has ever engaged in any outrageous behavior, all you have to do is go back and read these papers. And the war was so vicious that they laid traps for each other. The Journal published a story about how Colonel Philip Reluzit had been killed in the war. So the world, not having this story, republished it entirely until the Journal announced that the last name was really an anagram for "We Pilfer the News." Pulitzer's guilt in this is far less than William Randolph Hearst. And it's not because he's my guy and I spent all this time, but one of the things I discovered is his daughter, Lucille, had died in December. His favorite daughter. His favorite daughter because she was the only child who did what he wanted. And after her death, he went to Jekyll Island and stayed a recluse during this period. So really what you had was William Randolph Hearst competing with Pulitzer's soldiers without their general present. And they knew if they lost, the paper would be closed. They were never going to get a job with William Randolph Hearst. So when Pulitzer came back to his senses and came back to New York, he put an end to it. But what happened is that he became labeled a yellow journalist because of this. Just like a very famous president who lives in New York State, served for 8 years, but if I mention Clinton's name, we all think of one particular incident. Pulitzer forever is identified as a yellow journalist because of this period, and it will motivate his final act. But his final act, that's the end of the war, his final act comes after one more chapter, which is significant, and it's with this other New Yorker, Theodore Roosevelt. And Theodore Roosevelt is the classic media man. When he went up the hill in San Juan, who came with him? He understood the new media that Pulitzer created. He brought the press with him. Make sure you get me from the right side. His clothes were specially tailored. He was no fool. So one of the things that happened is he becomes this giant of American politics using the tools of the modern mass media invented by Pulitzer, and he and Pulitzer are arch enemies. They've been fighting since the 1870s. And Pulitzer, this is Pulitzer's condition at this point. He's old, he's blind, he's wearing goggles. This is Ralph walking him probably Fifth Avenue just a block away from here. But in 1908, his newspaper has a suggestion that perhaps the canal, the acquiring of the canal, was tinged by a little bit of corruption. Namely, that we paid off some French bondholders with money that from the federal government that we shouldn't have. Now, for Theodore Roosevelt, this was his crowning achievement. I mean, that was the one thing he cherished. So the temerity of this newspaper to suggest that there might be a little bit of corruption was too much. And Roosevelt ordered that the federal government prosecute this dangerous man and put him in prison for the rest of his life. We're not talking about simple libel. We're talking about a concept of criminal libel to put him in jail. So Roosevelt sends a note to a young, struggling U.S. attorney in New York with the name of Henry Stimson, whose first job out of college basically is being the prosecutor for the federal government here. And he has the backbone to say to the president, well, Mr. President, there isn't any kind of federal law like this. Roosevelt, I don't care if there's any federal law. You find something and put this guy in prison. And because Stimson isn't being very cooperative, Roosevelt gets two grand juries, one in Washington and one in New York, to indict Pulitzer and a whole bunch of people. And the scandal ensues. This is a cartoon showing the world building encircled by the wave. And I show this for two reasons. Three reasons. It shows the importance of the scandal at that moment. This symbol is so widely known that in anywhere in the world, in the U.S., they would have known what building that was. And then, of course, look at the manner in which Pulitzer's portrayed as a Jewish American with the different things they're using to portray him. Pulitzer fights this tooth and nail, goes all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reminds Roosevelt that presidents don't get to do this kind of thing. And a century later, a lot of the press freedoms that we have are owed to this moment. That's 1908. This is about 1909, 1910. This is perhaps the last photograph of Pulitzer. He's in Monaco with his daughter. This is one of his aides. Pulitzer was surrounded by 17 men who traveled with him as he went around the world in one of the most luxurious yachts. He was beset with this tremendous anxiety. Noise was his devil. If you were invited to have lunch with him, and you crunched on your celery or lettuce a little too much, you would get a letter the next day. Next time you have lunch with Mr. Pulitzer, no crunch, crunch, please. The White Star ocean liner that he used to go on before he had his own yacht, they would put special mats down on the floors above his rooms. They had doors that they brought out that were specially for his cabin. The piano player had to cease playing at 10. His house on 73rd Street, just down the way, his bedroom was designed with two sets of plate glass windows, inner walls. One of the floors was on the equivalent of ball bearings. He hired an acoustic expert from Harvard to come down and sleep in that room before he could sleep in it. He still found it too noisy. So he ended up his life as this Howard Hughes character, tormented and wandering the world. David Graham Phillips, one of the great and lesser-known novelists of that time, who had worked for Pulitzer, wrote a novel about Pulitzer, a thinly veiled novel. And he's the only one who really had the temerity and guts to write to Pulitzer at one point and say, you're fleeing your own shadow. You know, go to Europe, go everywhere, but your problems are inside, they're not out there. So he did not come to a very peaceful end of his life. But he did two final acts. He left his money to create this journalism school up the street. That's one of the earliest photographs of the journalism school. And to endow the prize, the Pulitzer Prize that we still have to this day. And in the Pulitzer Prize itself is an important remembrance of Pulitzer. A lot of people believe that he did this because he wanted to cleanse himself of that legacy of being a yellow journalist, which is really a bad term. But I think that's part of it. But I think the other part of it is that he entered journalism as a politician, seeking political power through journalism. Journalism was the other side of the coin at that time. But during that passage, he migrated to a very different philosophical position. He began to see journalism as a public service, as a public trust, words that may seem really odd today when we look at what's going on in journalism. But he believed that journalism had an important duty as in democracy, and that one of the keys to the economic independence a paper like his achieved was that it was free to criticize. It was a Democratic Party, but it criticized the Democratic Party. It had the freedom to light the dark recesses of the halls of government, because journalism's most powerful tool is simply expose what's going on. It had the power to set the public agenda by promoting causes of reform. And these were all things he came to believe, and the most important prize, as far as he was concerned, was the prize for public service, which is still awarded. The third reason he left the journalism school, and a lot of kids don't even notice this, is if you walk across the hall, you'll find that is erected in memory of his daughter Lucille, his most cherished child, who died in 1897. So that's the Baedeker's Guide to Pulitzer's Life. There's still 460 pages in the book, so I've left you some of the good stories. And I'm more than glad to take some questions. And it's warm in here. You've been very patient with me, so thank you. Yes. Oh, yes. People say that I hit on his lying an awful lot in the book. By then, he was a full citizen. The reason I particularly relished the lying to be in the military, the lying when he swears allegiance to the Missouri Constitution, I even didn't mention the moment before that. He becomes a citizen about a year before that. At that point, you had to be in the U.S. for 5 years before you could become a citizen. He had not been, but you know, it's a minor little discrepancy. The reason I love that is, of course, if Pulitzer was a publisher and he discovered that a politician lied to join the army, lied to become a citizen, lied to serve, what do you think he would do with it? And I like it because it's a reminder that no matter who they are, they all have clay feet. Yes? Two of his children did. Pulitzer was deeply disappointed by his kids. One of his cousins wrote him and said, "Joseph, you don't get it. You grew up with nothing. They're growing up with everything. They're going to be very different." So Ralph and Herbert got the New York World. The daughters got trust funds. And the one son who had his name, Joseph Pulitzer, was the talented member of the family, but as far as his father was concerned, was the black sheep of the family. When he was at St. Mark's, he went into town and got some beer and came back with his friends. This is just one of many examples of Joseph II, and climbed up the ivy back into what he thought would have been his dorm, only to find he landed in the headmaster's bedroom. And so Pulitzer banished him to Siberia, a.k.a. St. Louis. And the irony is that the New York World collapses 20 years later under the management of Ralph and Herbert. The one paper that goes on to have a second distinguished career is the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It actually becomes even a better paper under Joseph II. So the black sheep of the family very often are the ones with talent, but Joseph couldn't recognize that in his own children. He was incredibly cruel to his kids. I mean, there are times when I know I'm a softie and all that, but I was in tears sometimes transcribing some of the letters of the kids. They wrote to each other, and they were so desperate for their father's affection. They would have done anything for it, and it was one of these push and pull things. He wanted them, but he constantly pushed them away. And the heroine of this book is Kate Pulitzer. I mean, I would have dumped him after 5 years. She did find friendship in one other person for a little while, and I think when you read that part, you say, "You go, girl." But she's the only one who truly understood him. And what I mean by that, it's the same task I had as a biographer. There's different forms of cruelty in life. There are people who purposely go out of their way across the street to squish a bug. There are other people who do so because of the devils that beset them. Pulitzer lashed out at people because of what was happening to him internally. It was not a cruel streak, it was a cruel act. Kate understood that, and one of the most wonderful things she did for him before he lost his eyesight entirely, she took the locket he'd kept all these years of his mother and did the 21st century equivalent of going to Kinko's and having it blown up. She hired an artist to paint a huge version so before he lost his eyesight entirely, he could have one more sight of his mother. That, to me, was an example of Kate's love. Yes, sir. It is very much still there, as well as Ralph's house, which he bought for him when he got married as a wedding present and made sure it was right next door. And they're both still there. It's divided into, you can tell I'm not a New Yorker, condos or co-ops or whatever you call it, but it's all been sliced up. And I've heard from different people who live there, they'll say, I have the room that was the swimming pool, I have this room or that room. And Dover has a beautiful book, which I wouldn't be surprised if it's not in his collection, of Stanford White Houses with these incredible photographs of the interior. It's very lavish. So Bulitzer built that house. He built a house in Maine, and he built a house in Jekyll Island. So he had three beautiful mansions. The one in Maine burnt down, the one in Jekyll Island burnt down. And the yacht that he had, which was the second biggest, only a few feet shorter than Morgan's Corsair, was eventually destroyed after, I think, about 5 or 10 years after World War I. Scrap metal. Yes, sir. He grew up as a very unusual form of Judaism in Hungary. If you know anything about Judaic history in Eastern Europe, Hungary has a group called Neologues, which are an extraordinarily secular group of Jews in that their major cathedral, major synagogue, which is the second largest in the world, was nicknamed the Jewish Cathedral because it's almost laid out like a Christian church. They had an organ to play music, but of course, since they couldn't play the music on the Sabbath, they had to hire a Christian to come in and play it on that day. I say this because it's a very secular form of Judaism, so when he comes to the United States, he's forever identified in 19th century terms as a Hebrew, but he doesn't practice, he never goes to any synagogue, he marries an Episcopalian in Washington, D.C., baptizes his children Episcopalian, and Joseph, I think it was Joseph, discovers at boarding school that his dad was Jewish. He comes home to his mother after being teased and said, "What's this about dad being Jewish?" And like all mothers, she says, "They're very nice, many nice Jews in this world," you know, and goes on to talk about them like that. The importance for him is his social identification. And when New York changes, because when he first comes to New York, he doesn't run into this. This is part of a very tough period for him in that sense. But he doesn't in any way think of himself that way. Yes, in the back.
New York was a very German-speaking place when he came to that place.
Yes. Yes. Well, I can only take a guess. I mean, he did not write a memoir. You're right, there was a strong German population here. New York had no jobs for veterans at that point. There was this antipathy, as he demonstrated, being thrown out of French's Hotel. And you could get to St. Louis for very little money because the trains had these immigrant cars with no seats in them, a coal heating device, and for very few pennies you get. This is all conjecture, and I didn't even put it in my book. I suspect the time he spent with the other German Union soldiers in Washington when they were being disbanded, somebody probably said, you know, St. Louis is a good place to go. Sir?
I haven't lived in St. Louis for some years. The Jewish community, when people in the immediate pre-Civil War period, they tend to come through New York, go down the Ohio Valley.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And St. Louis became a very strongly identified German group and became a goal. People then, as they became successful, then returned to, as many of the German Jewish merchants did, to come back to
Yeah, there's a. I'm sure you're familiar with Lion in the Valley, a great book on the history of Jews in St. Louis. What I liked for me was I did a lot of work in the Missouri Historical Society right off Forest Park. It occupies a deconsecrated synagogue, and it's like working in a miniature Library of Congress, one of the most beautiful buildings, and I felt that connection all the times I was there. We should probably only take a couple more because I think people are going to pass out. Yes? Oh, well, it could be. Yeah. Well, there is a reverence to the media. I didn't bring included in this, but I have a slide of a stained glass window that was inside it. Stained glass window would be similar, of the Statue of Liberty. When they tore down the building in 1955, they preserved that stained glass window, and if you go to the Columbia Journalism School, it's in a room called the World Room, where the Pulitzer Prizes are announced. One other artifact, which I invite you to listen to, Pulitzer's group was keenly aware that building the world was a media event. So a group of reporters in 1889, when they were laying the cornerstone, went into an office building and spoke to a new device, a wax cylinder recording. And they had a microphone. And if any of you have ever experienced the business of giving a mic to your most talkative child, and they suddenly have no idea what to say, this is what they're like. So they begin, and the recording, the reason I'm telling you is the recording exists, and it's on my website. You can go and listen to it. And they begin by reading the serial number on the machine that they're recording. But as they loosen up, they become true reporters, and they begin to say, 1889, boy, that was a great year for disasters, wasn't it? And they list all the great disasters that occurred. They predict that Chicago will not get the World's Fair. They mention a minor baseball team from New York that's doing pretty well, and it lasts for about 2 or 3 minutes. When they tore down the building, they looked for the cornerstone, and they could not find it. And one of those clamshell things, devices, picked up part of the building, and as it dropped it, the stone broke open, and in it was the copper box. And that box is at Columbia. Several of the photographs of the family that were in that box are in my book. And the recording was preserved that's in there. And I'll end on this one note. One of the pictures in there is of a young baby named Constance. And she's born in Paris. I met Constance's daughter, Vivian Elmsley, and I showed her the photograph. She never knew her mother was born in Paris and had never seen it. So it was kind of, you know, a great reward as a biographer. I'll be sticking around to answer questions individually. I just think we're going to be needing, you know, vapors or having vapors in a minute. So thank you very much. It was really nice to be with you.